A discussion now of the persistence of poverty in America. A discussion that probably won't be part of the 2012 presidential election campaign. Well, there'll be plenty of talk about the economy and jobs and many references to the income disparities in America. Probably a lot of arguing about who it is that creates all those jobs. Peter Edelman, what won't we be hearing in the fall campaign regarding poverty in America that concerns you the most right now?
What concerns me the most, and I'm afraid we might not hear enough about it, is the 20 million people who are actually in deep poverty, who have incomes below half the poverty line, astonishing, below $9,000 for a family of three.
20 million. One of the most outspoken voices in our time on the issue of poverty, Peter Edelman, is in our studio right there. You just heard him. In the 60s, he served as a legislative assistant to Senator Robert F. Kennedy, specializing in policy related to poverty. In the 1990s, he served under President Clinton in the Department of Health and Human Services, resigning after Clinton signed into law the controversial Republican-backed welfare reform bill. Peter Edelman's new book is called So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. Welcome to our studios here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see you, John.
It's great to see you, too. And let me just ask right off the top, one of the things that is so, portrayed in this book is the population of poverty in America has completely changed from the period we associate with the 30s and 40s when Social Security came into being and a lot of the programs that we understand today came into being. Poverty used to be an elderly phenomenon. It's not today. Why and what's changed politically?
We did a very good job for the elderly, and that's great. Social Security was indexed to inflation in the early 1970s, and we enacted SSI, Supplemental Security Insurance. So now the elderly are poor at a rate that's lower than that for the rest of the population. That's terrific. It shows you that public policy really works. But at the same time, starting in the 1970s, we've had a kind of deadly combination of two things. One is an absolute freezing of wages for just about everybody below, or all the jobs below the middle. And then coupled with that, the changes in family structure in this country. So many more moms out there by themselves trying to raise kids, struggling and not being able to make it on just one job. And so now the children are our poorest age group in the country.
And when we speak in our political campaign about the middle class and about family values, we're talking about a time, and you describe this in the book, that hasn't existed for more than a generation, in the sense that a head of household could get a job in manufacturing or some traditional work and own a home and pay for all the expenses of raising a family. That is not only not true, but it hasn't been true for a long time.
That is the case. It's been, if you will, sort of sneaking up on us because we haven't paid attention as a country to this. And I think that's one of the reasons why, even though we've done a lot to help low-income people, we've just barely kept up in terms of poverty. The economy has been terrible for decades now for the lowest, for the bottom half of everybody in this country. And so now there's so many more people who are in low-wage jobs, and they just can't make it on one wage. People where there's a mom and a dad where they can both go out and work, and then there's a lot of problems about child care, at least have a chance of being in the middle class, maybe the lower part of it. But if somebody's all by themselves with one job, too many low-wage jobs now.
I can recall the speeches of Lyndon Johnson and recalling it again with the new Robert Carroll book out about LBJ's presidency. I can recall the speeches about a war on poverty. And I can know from history the extraordinary political changes that came about that produced the entitlement programs we, in a sense, take for granted today. But for most of my career and for most of the political careers of everybody in office today, we've been tweaking programs that we inherited, in a sense, and that's been our anti-poverty program. And we haven't done anything terribly significant on the order of the anti-poverty programs of the 60s or before. Can you remind us of the political will that was required to create the infrastructure that is so rickety and imperfect today?
Of course, the beginning of it was the civil rights movement. Now, I'd take issue with the fact that we've been playing around the edges, because we've enacted programs that are keeping 40 million people out of poverty now. And many of those were enacted not only during the 1960s, but in the time since, during the Nixon period, even somewhat under Reagan and Bush, although Reagan really was not helpful to poor people, to say the least. But what happened in the 1960s, to put it very simply, is that because of the push for racial justice and ending the apartheid that we really had in this country, people woke up, starting with Dr. King, but others, and said, well, the legal right to have a meal at a lunch counter isn't worth much if you can't pay for it. So if you think about the 1963 March on Washington, it was a march for jobs and justice. Jobs and justice. It was a direct outcome of the civil rights movement, and that's where the impetus came from. And also, President Kennedy campaigning in 1960 and seeing poverty in Appalachia and being influenced by that. So those two things came together. There was a consciousness, and of course Lyndon Johnson was very determined about racial justice, and also did support and sign and really push the war on poverty.
One of the most astounding statistics in this book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America, is that, and it mentions one of the programs that you just described that we actually have been successful with in America in the past generation or two, that there are 6 million people in America whose only income is food stamps.
That is true, and that is appalling. It's unbelievable. But what has happened is that really the old idea of welfare, of cash assistance for moms and kids, is basically gone in this country. In 1996, President Clinton signed into law the thing that's called temporary assistance to needy families, and that leaves it up to the states essentially what they will do, whether they will have anybody help anybody at all, because there used to be a legal entitlement. There isn't anymore, and so we're down from 14 million people, which was too many, to about a little over 4 million people, and you take that around the country, and you have, for example, Wyoming, where only 4% of children in poor families are receiving cash assistance. So food stamps is it at the bottom. And, of course, there are a lot more people at the bottom now because of the combination of the changes in the economy and the recession.
Is one of the things that frustrates you that, as important as food stamps are to be at the bottom there, if somebody thought through this program, we'd have something else there at the bottom, as opposed to this almost accidental sense of, oh, well, this program kind of overlaps here, but this one we've torn out, and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, you know, ends as it's just getting started for so many families?
Absolutely. The safety net, which works in some ways for people a little higher up, the Earned Income Tax Credit for a working family with a couple of kids, minimum wage job, adds $5,000 to their income. That's really strong. But what has happened is that people who are at the very bottom have only sporadic employment, live in places that are far away from jobs. All of that leaves us with a huge hole at the bottom. And we need to first recognize that that exists, recognize that we're up to 20 million people in deep poverty. And then we need to have a very baseline safety net in this country that we don't have. Food stamps is not enough.
Can we make those investments with the political will you see around you in 2012?
Right now, we're at a time where, because of the Tea Party and basically the opposition on the Hill, it's defensive. You have Paul Ryan with his budget that wants to slash and smash everything. People need to wake up and be aware that programs that help people, not just at the bottom, although that's obviously very important, but help people who need help all the way on up through twice the poverty line. 103 million people now living on incomes less than twice the poverty line, below $44,000 for a family of four. That's astonishing, a third of the American people. So, number one, we have to play defense. Now we have to fight to keep what we have, and then we have to lay the groundwork for moving forward.
And recognize that those investments actually assist in stability in America. They aren't money thrown down the drain. Peter Edelman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Peter Edelman is the author of the new book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America, one of the most outspoken voices on policy and poverty in the United States.
Maybe you should have a background in poverty in order to be qualified to be president of America. We're talking about qualifications for the White House today. What do you think is required in order to be a good president? Here's Pete in Antioch, Tennessee.
The profession is best suited for a president of the United States would be any profession other than a lawyer, because lawyers trained to argue, and you don't want that in a president.
Well, that would be bad news for the current president, who's a Harvard-trained lawyer. Not bad news for Mitt Romney, though. Give us your take. Any profession that makes you qualified for president? 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.